Hi, this is Paul. Yesterday when I was doing something with the dog, I was watching a little bit of YouTube while I was, throwing stuff back and forth to the dog, giving the dog some exercise, doing some things with the dog. And this video, Grace or Grift, The Right and Wrong Ways to Treat OnlyFans Convert by Trent Hall came up. And it had just posted and Algo sent it to my feed right away. And I thought that was interesting because really, apart from his conversation with our Sam, that's what I should call Sam Tiedemann from now on. He's our Sam. Besides our Sam, thinking about what Frodo would always say to Sam the gardener. From our Sam, I had never watched videos from him. And then this one came up right away. And I watched the Peugeot video about the interpretation of Luke 16, which I might make a video on because that's very interesting. And in some ways, it's sort of connected to this. But I thought that was very interesting. And I didn't know anything about this whole situation. I got some guidance from Rick, who knew sort of what was going on with Pearl and that whole business. But I remember that Wokel had said something to me in our conversation.
Leftists have in a beautiful trouble, which is the leftist toolkit. They say, beware the tyranny of structurelessness. Right? The left wants, I want to destroy all the hierarchies, but I still want a structure. Well, that's not going to go very far. So even they understand the need for structure, right? So the political right wants to wield power and exercise power, but the political right doesn't want to or hasn't been able to do the work to make their vision compelling. They haven't put forth a positive vision yet that's compelling. We love to critique, and we're very good at it. In a certain sense, we're where the left was in the 80s with critical theory. But at some point, a compelling vision needs to be put forth.
And that is...
And I'd like...
Go ahead. Keep going.
I'd like to suggest that my simple paintings are... I am the Bob Ross that's getting rid of the desert landscapes. What did Klein say? That we've offended the sensibilities of those who prefer desert landscapes? I'm Bob Ross, and I'm paying happy little metaphysics all over their little desert landscapes.
Well, that is, I mean, that you said, it caught my attention. You were talking to Benjamin Boyce, and I don't remember who else was in the conversation, but you said that then too, and I think it's still important. And I see that in a lot of different spaces on the right, where they are working really hard to say no, not the left, without recognizing that most of those people on the left used to be their people, and if they can't figure out what happened and what failed, they will never actually be able to address why all these people left.
Yes. Yeah. That is like they walked out on you.
Right.
Why?
Right.
They're coming back now.
Right.
Why? This is the OnlyFans girl. I posted on Twitter yesterday. So a lot of people were going on this OnlyFans girl who recently converted to Christianity.
Okay.
Have you seen this?
No.
This Nala Ray.
I have no idea.
This OnlyFans girl who kind of got escape velocity. She's got red hair, and she was going on all these things talking about the joy of cheating and being on OnlyFans. And then recently she's come out and I'm a Christian now. And she was on Michael Knowles' podcast.
Oh.
I like Jesus now. And I've turned away from this. And all the right was dogging on her, being like, oh, she's just moving from one space to another. And so I put up a tweet with a picture of her and her red hair on the Michael Knowles podcast.
Yeah, I see it.
And I said, I do not know Nala Ray's heart, but what does it matter? The important thing is that in every way, whether from false motives or true, Christ is preached, and because of this, I rejoice.
What's
being
the story with this woman? She was an OnlyFans, or is an OnlyFans, and she's
was
converted.
An OnlyFans model, and then she had a conversion, got baptized, and then is claiming Christ and to preach Christ.
Well, I can understand why she'd leave it. I mean, that's just it. It doesn't take a brain surgeon to think of that. Yeah, OnlyFans model, not a great strategy for life. So, why would people dump on her for this?
Well, she was grifting there. Now she's grifting for clout on Christianity. They think that she's made She was an e-girl. They're saying she's just picked up a new audience now. OnlyFans slowed down for her, so now she's moving to something else. And the right is being cynical. Why are we giving this woman a platform? And I sat there and I thought, look, man, the reason that the right has a grifter problem is because all of the people who could have done this work decided that they just wanted to stay home and grill. They didn't want to get involved. And now they're looking around and saying, well, I just want to come in and fix it and don't. And I'm going to take power. You stop that and blah, blah, blah. It's like,
They just wanted to come in and grill. I thought that was a great line. So I don't know if Algo, pick stuff up like that, or if it's just the patterns of those of us watching, or why Algo gives us what we do, but gave me this Trent, this Council of Trent video. And I want to say before I say anything else that the main point he makes here with respect to Christianity and conversion and God loving sinners and God redeeming us, no matter how deep, and the thief on the, I mean, you just, this the point he makes seems to be, especially for me, a Protestant, and I'm not saying Catholics can't make this point, but for me, it seems to be the most obvious point to make. So let me say before I say anything else, and I want you to try and remember what I'm saying right now throughout this video, because I have a lot more to say, because there's a lot more nuance to point to in terms of what's happening in the broader cultural conversation with respect to Christianity. Let me again first say I agree with the main point he's making in this video. Please, please, please don't forget that point. And I'll probably remind you again and again as we go, because even if you agree on the main point, there's more things to see, and more things to see with respect to how our culture continues to sort of evolve and move with respect to Christianity and the faith, and especially theological language, and especially sort of the new movements in faith. Now, sort of things have been, we're going from a Protestant era to a contestant era. I love it when Chad the Alcoholic made that comment in one of the live streams. We don't have the Protestant Reformation anymore. We have the contestant Reformation. And I think I want to show as we talk about what he says in this video how that's true. But again, don't forget the main point he makes in this video, I agree with. Okay? Please don't forget that. Although I know full well some of you in the comments section will forget that I made this point and argue it below. And everyone else who sees you doing that, at least those who remember the point I'm making now, will read that comment and say, oh, and they'll know something about you. But let's continue.
Week, Michael Knowles interviewed Nala Ray, a woman who allegedly made $9 million on OnlyFans before giving up her life as a pornographer to become a Christian. But not everyone is happy about it.
Now, let me say, the red hair, I mean, kind of looks like Raggedy Ann. Anyway, I just, to me, and I'm an equal opportunity hair color person, especially given the fact that I have none. But back in the day, there were the blue-haired ladies, and they were like the older church ladies, and now it's all colors, and I don't get it. Anyway, I'm old. Ignore what I said.
You can see on the original video about 1 out of 10 people disliked it, and there are lots of angry comments about it online. Right-wing commenter Laura Loomer said, "These OnlyFans girls can pray their slutty behavior away all they want. They will never be respectable, no matter how much they cry to God. Praying to be a respectable person doesn't work once you do sex work. It's best that we shun women like this from society forever." Another.
Wow. And again, it's been the, and I'm not going to talk about, well, I'm going to talk about Catholicism tangentially here. But basically, my understanding of most Protestants from Luther forward, this has been an easy one, okay? Because total depravity, saved by grace, here it is. But here's where the tensions come in. I made a video. It was actually a rough draft for Sunday, and I made another video connected with it, and it was about Father Stephen DeYoung and Jordan Peterson talking about the resurrection. And I made the distinction, which pretty much anybody who sort of studies theology will understand, between, let's say, realized eschatology and anticipated eschatology. Now, this now and not yet tension gets reflected in many different ways, especially the language of this very short word that we use, and that has become sort of a buzzword and a code word in many ways by Protestants, because Protestants have in some ways, as Luke Thompson in the video that I made about orthodoxy and metamodernity that I released today, Protestants got really good at sort of being able to use this word and deploy it. And they used the word and deployed it as a package, but it had a lot in the package, and most of the time people don't pause and sort of take the package apart and understand the tensions within it. And this is where it comes into the other video that I watched that morning, which was Jonathan Peugeot's exegesis of...
What Christ is describing is the manner in which you change worlds. When a world is ending, the way to move into a new world is to take the strength of the world that is ending and seed it into the next world, so that when this world ends, you find a place in the next world. You know, if you look at it morally, it's very difficult, but if you look at it in terms of just it is how a world ends and how another begins, you can understand how that's the type of shrewd behavior that you would want to do.
Okay, so Jonathan goes through a very interesting parable, the parable right after arguably one of Jesus' most famous parables, the parable of the prodigal son, to the parable of the unjust steward, or the crooked steward. And this steward robs from his master. And I've preached on this sermon before. I've talked about this parable before. I've talked about this parable quite a bit. I like Kenneth Bailey's take on this parable. I might do a video that talks about this. But I wanted to note, as I did in the Jordan Peterson video, part of what is going on right now in terms of sort of the new Christianization, the surprising rebirth and re-engagement with Christianity that's happening in the culture, is a lot of this is playing on this tension between realized and anticipated. It has everything to do with the secular and the eternal, okay? And I'm using those words very carefully and intentionally. Even Jordan Peterson's conversation with Daniel Dennett and my treatment of those. A lot of what you can understand about Daniel Dennett is that everything has sort of been brought down and secularized because of our skepticism that there is anything beyond death. And so everything is immanentized. Everything is sort of brought near. And this has been this has been something that has been moving over the last 6-7 years in terms of how, well, Jordan Peterson talks about the Bible, it seems much more applicable. A lot of this is sort of an immanentizing move. I don't really feel like trying to dig it up, but I saw on Twitter that someone had made a comment. I don't remember if it was to Peugeot, but it was someone sort of in this new circle. Their anxiety about symbolism, and they made the connection, and quite rightly so, I thought it was very astute, and I think it's very accurate, that there's a connection between the symbologizing that happened in the modernist movement as they sort of demythologized and secularized the Bible, and sort of what's been happening in the, let's say, the new symbolism that's coming forward. And one of the moves that Jonathan makes, again, Jonathan's my friend, this would be a great conversation for Jonathan and I to talk about. I should give him a little nicer. There we go. There's a nicer picture of Jonathan. Is a big piece of this, a big piece of this re-Christianization that has been happening. Many people who are sort of going back into, is it right to call the Orthodox conservative? On one hand, they are, can be enormously conservative, but this right and left, conservative, progressive, isn't really, it's a very low resolution dynamic to try to place everything into. Now, if we look at, let's say, imminent, realized versus anticipated future, so much of Jonathan's work, so much of Jordan Peterson's work, so much of what I hear happening in order to have people feel that the Bible is relevant to them, and you can hear Jordan Peterson complain about that whole relevance thing. Jonathan Peugeot is helping make the Bible relevant to people by immanentizing the Bible. Part of where this is different from, let's say, classical, let's say, 19th and 20th century Christian classical liberalism is they tended to immanentize in the form of moralism. And Jonathan often sort of takes a turn from moralism and continues to use symbolism, but it is much more sort of a perennialism. This is the way the structure works. And so with this parable in particular, which is a very difficult parable for people, it's people stumble over the morality of it. And part of the reason they stumble over the morality of it is because both fundamentalists and modernists, in terms of the fundamentalist-modernist controversy, so much of that tension was about historical correspondentism, okay? And what the modernists tended to do is say, we can't trust the Bible for history in terms of historical correspondentism, but we can trust it for morality. Now, of course, that all comes to an end after the Cold War, and the new atheists sort of turn and attack the morality of that had been simply assumed during the Cold War period and said, oh no, the Bible is immoral. I've talked about that. I've been talking about that for years on this channel and sort of made that move. And so now over on the, all the way on the other end of it, Jonathan Peugeot basically says, you can understand the way the Bible, he immanentizes by talking about the way the Bible talks about this world here and now via the symbolism in the Bible. If you understand it, the Bible, basically, if you understand the Bible and symbolism, it lays it, the world lays itself out this week. And he basically shows that the structures of the Bible are the structures of reality, not so much with this modernist physical correspondentism, not so much with this view from above, but rather from a more perennial view through understanding basically a number of the main work, the main thing that Jonathan Peugeot constantly tries to do is take everyone from sort of the third person into the first person. And if you see it from the perspective of the first person, as John Calvin had said about a lot of things in the Bible, as St. Augustine had said about a lot of things in the Bible, as many other church fathers had said about a lot of things in the Bible, the Bible is written from the perspective of the common man, and Jonathan Peugeot has basically taken that from sort of this third-person, modern perspective, monarchical vision, bringing it down to the first person. It says, if you understand it from this perspective, the Bible speaks about the perennial structures of this world, the perennial patterns of this world, and therefore you can understand this very difficult parable of the unjust steward or the crooked steward and say, you can connect it up with, let's say, Rahab and the conquest of Jericho and the scarlet cord that goes down, the part of the wall that stays and says, well, this is a boundary marker and this is a guide for perennially, this is how worlds end. Now, of course, you're also understanding worlds symbolically, and that scales. It fractals all the way up, all the way down. Standard stuff for those of you who have been watching Jonathan for a number of years. But I often find people, they see what Jonathan is seeing, and they say, oh, yeah. Jordan Peterson made a very similar move. He said, well, basically, the Bible lays itself out psychologically, and you can understand things of the world by looking at these biblical patterns, and then he does all the things he does with it. And this is not a trick or an insider thing. This is basically taking what Jonathan has been doing and saying, okay, now what Jonathan has basically moved people from is sort of this moral frame into this perennial structural biblical frame. And then suddenly the Bible is immanentized again and now works for my life. Now, even though this is able to happen at the recession of modernity, this remains a deeply secularizing thing. Now, I don't mean secularizing in terms of not Christian or not faith or skepticism, let's say, about eternity or life after. I'm not saying any of that with that word secularizing. Secularizing, again, means sort of the seculum, this world. This is the way the world is. The Bible reveals the world as it is. These perennial patterns lay themselves out, and we can understand the patterns of the world. And even the title of this video, How to Survive the End of the World, A Parable of Christ, says, okay, here's the structure of world's ending. This is how you can navigate. What's interesting is that, and again, it's not a criticism. Maybe Jonathan, I should write him and say, let's talk about this. This isn't too different from 1980 Countdown to Armageddon, a book that was popular when I was young. You know, the bear is the Soviet Union. And so you'd have all of this symbolism. Now, this tended to be in a dispensational frame, and there were certain interpretive moves by dispensational theology that sort of lent itself to them. But a number of people made a very healthy income, which is not a bad thing. They sold a lot of books, basically prognosticating about the end of the world. And this has been a perennial feature of Christianity for a very long time. Now, maybe I can sort of illustrate how this works here.
The manner in which you change worlds, which is the manner in which when a world is ending, the way to move into a new world is to take the strength of the world that is ending and seed it into the next world, so that when this world ends, you find a place in the next world.
Now notice again, and again, this is not a criticism. I know there's gonna be a lot of people get defensive for Jonathan here. I don't think he'd be defensive for himself, but he's said this is the pattern, and so he's not being skeptical about the end of the world in a physical sense. But he's saying, this is the pattern. It's in the parable. You can see it in Rahab and Jericho. But this is the pattern when worlds end. And this is a very common, this is what Jonathan does a lot. Now, again, I want to note, this is an immanentizing. Now, a big piece of one of the interesting things about the entrance of orthodoxy and orthodox teaching into the conversation is, by and large, Augustinian theology on the American scene had not a lot of skepticism with respect to, let's say, the existence of hell. Okay, so now we're gonna think about that whole debate. And in terms of orthodoxy, these issues have been debated for a very long time. And I would say that as a percentage, more and more universalists seem to come through orthodoxy than through others. Now, again, there's some interesting similarities between sort of what had been happening theologically through modernism, that was a lot of skepticism with respect to let's talk about perdition. Okay, let's talk about perdition. Let's use that word, because that word's a little less freighted and triggering than hell, or even this newfangled attempt to, you know, this newfangled thing called eternal conscious torment, which I didn't hear until just a few years ago. But perdition. So when we hear this discussed, okay, so again, by and large, most conservative Protestants and Roman Catholics, because principally, even though most Protestants wouldn't think in these terms, all Protestants are sort of rebel Catholics, okay? Because they come out of the Catholic Church. Now, the Protestants just sort of went wild, and most Protestants wouldn't think of themselves as Catholics. And now that sort of the war between Protestants and Catholics has probably reached a historic level of lack of conflict between them now. Never in my life have I seen Protestants and Catholics behaving so well together. Let's hope that Trent Horn doesn't place that back with something he said in his little video. But most of them, there aren't a lot of universalists in that camp. And I would imagine that on a per capita basis, there are probably more universalists in the Orthodox camp. And I think part of that reason is because one of the things that I tend to hear when I listen to a lot of Orthodox talking is, along similar lines, a lot of immanentizing of things. And even in Father Stephen DeYoung's talk that he gave at the Symbolic World Conference, there was a good amount of immanentizing, which sort of left Jordan Peterson ready to ask that question, well, what about after I die? So Jordan Peterson, listening to everything that Stephen DeYoung was talking about in terms of the salvation of, let's say, the example that he'd used of this really obnoxious woman that was in an illustration of the story that he told. There's a lot of immanentizing of salvation, okay? And this is where a good number of tensions between Protestants and Catholics sort of emerge, a lot of them around the Catholic doctrine of purgatory. Because purgatory, if you think long enough about a number of things, even though I remain Protestant, I can understand why. I can understand why the theological invention of purgatory would arise, because there are sort of tensions in a narrative and missing spaces in a narrative. And the Protestant reformers basically said no to purgatory because they couldn't find scriptural evidence for it. But the tension between realized eschatology and anticipated eschatology is very much there in scripture. In fact, I was looking over the text that the narrative lectionary that I've been using. I don't really like how the narrative lectionary has managed sort of Easter to Pentecost this year. I might go out and look for another lectionary. I've got dissatisfaction with the Revised Common Lectionary. I've got dissatisfaction now with the Narrative Lectionary sometimes. So anyway, but at the beginning of the book of 1 Thessalonians, you can very much see sort of this apocalyptic vision of the Apostle Paul. But these tensions about realized and anticipated are there not only in terms of, let's say, perennial structures of the world, but also in terms of, well, how much salvation is realized and how much salvation is anticipated. Now, having said all that, I want to return to this video. Now that you sort of understand the frame, when you listen to him, ask yourself, when he says the word salvation, you will almost always hear him speak it in an anticipated focus, not in a realized. And when you go back to what I said to Wokel, I very much said, well, I can understand why she wants to get off OnlyFans, even if she's not going to make all that money. I can understand why she's coming to Jesus, because by all accounts, being a pornographer, at least an actor in these things, is bad for you. It's not good for your love life. It's not good for your body. It's not good for your relationships. It's not good for anything. Now, all of this tension that's happening over this poor girl, if you understand this difference in when and where, suddenly some interesting things begin to appear. Now, I have long been trying to point to this dynamic. And I have often, you will find me saying this way back in the videos, whenever you try to bring heaven down, you bring hell up. Now, all of that is sort of a fancy way to say, if you exclude anticipated eschatology, anticipated salvation, everything then has to be immanentized. And what you find is that this world is too small a canvas to paint the full pictures that we need. Okay? And this is why I began this video saying, I have zero problem with Trent Horn's pointing to anticipated salvation, meaning, well, what does that mean? Means reigning with Christ in the age to come. I prefer that language to a lot of other language that is very popular and out there. I think it's a little bit more accurate. Reigning with Christ in the age to come. Union with Christ in the age to come. Now, when I say union with Christ, right away you can begin to feel the tensions between immanentized, I'm united with Christ in his baptism. And Paul is always going like this with this language. I am united with Christ in his baptism. We are saints, and you can read that when he talks to the church in Corinth. I mean, verse after verse, he tells them what lousy Christians they are, and yet they are saints. And so Paul is always going back and forth between them, and he's holding both of them together, and I think we must too. Now, when it comes to these spats about someone like this poor OnlyFans girl, this is what happens, because notice how this whole right-left divide sort of goes into the background, because those, let's say, who were thoroughly secular in that they were skeptical about anything anticipated or age to come or life after death or any of those things, well, suddenly everything, the only thing that matters is what's going on in the seculum. Okay? Now, the other way this goes is so often what has happened in Christian language, especially I think in Roman Catholics and the Orthodox, have sort of been scrambling this, and that's sort of what's made kind of the dynamism of the moment and people sort of becoming very conservative, not realizing that in some ways they're not that different from some modernists. CW is really going to love this video, I think, is that there's some really interesting commonalities that sort of emerge. And, well, I'm going to open the door. It's getting hot. Weather's warming up in Sacramento. Okay, here we go.
Our ex-user says, Christians believe this woman can truly be saved. The naivety of conservative Christians is driving more people towards atheism and Islam. The same naivety that is making your society crumble. Accept everything and fall for anything.
Okay, so what does that person mean? This woman can truly be saved. Now, Trent Horn, for the most part, is basically going to talk about realized eschatology in this. The argument that he's going to make is, anything that you do here in the seculum, Jesus can save you from in the age to come. Now, the whole idea of purgatory was that some of this stuff is going to have to be paid for. And then you get into the whole thing of indulgences. Okay. Now, it's interesting, because if Islam will have Andrew Tate, I don't think they'll have a problem with this woman. And atheism is interesting, because again, what happened in sort of the modernist move was it sort of destructured everything. And so Peugeot is sort of restructuring everything, but it moralized everything. And you can see again in Peugeot often sort of a, we're going to demoralize this. We're going to look. And now if you go back and you find what I said about that thing, you'll find that I make a different move. It's a very Protestant move. But for Peugeot, okay, that parable really isn't about morality, because if you think too much about morality, it doesn't make sense. He says a number of times in the video. But what you're looking at is basically sort of, once you begin to understand a bunch of these structures that almost everything that flows through theologically sort of has to contend with, you begin to appreciate the tensions between them.
Is making your society crumble. Accept everything and fall for anything. Today I'm going to talk about the mercy and love of God. I'm going to talk about the gospel, because it never hurts to go back to the basics. So what is the gospel?
One of my favorite Tim Keller things that he would say again and again and again is that people will often, just like Trent Horn did right here, say that the gospel is like this basic thing and then we build on top of it. And Tim Keller, I think, was exactly right when he said the gospel is never just the basic thing. The gospel is, in some ways, the only thing. And all of your life, as you wrestle to be remade into the image of Christ, it is always gospel work. It is gospel work for justification and sanctification. Now, I just introduced those two words, and a whole bunch of lights came on, because you were catechized in Protestantism. And even though those two words don't necessarily pertain exclusively to this tension between realized and anticipated, functionally in a low-resolution way, that's often how Christians will use them. Justification is for anticipated salvation. Sanctification is for realized salvation. And again, what Tim Keller used to say is that actually the gospel is working both with justification and sanctification at the same time.
Gospel is the good news of salvation through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ.
Okay, now when he said salvation, it's ambiguous, but I think most listeners will hear that, well, she'll have union with Christ when she dies. And I think, again, a good understanding would say her move away from her previous occupation is a step towards and a realization of the union with Christ that is beginning inside of her. Now, someone again might say, well, that's sanctification. I'd say, yes, that is. But also some of the tension between sanctification and justification is often, justification sort of feels like a binary. You're in or you're out. And that tends to be the way we talk about anticipated salvation. You either are united with Christ or you're ostracized from Christ. And of course, there's a lot of interesting moves in this. You can read, you know, for example, St. C.S. Lewis in his book, The Great Divorce, plays with these by bringing them back and forth, because you have, basically, you have people in the gray world interacting with the foothills of the eternal world. And so C.S. Lewis is actually playing with all of these. Now, of course, C.S. Lewis had probably read almost everything from the ancient world, and he, as many Orthodox notice, he was well-versed with church fathers all up and down, and he understood a great deal of this. And because he was such an ardent medievalist, many of the things that he played with in his sort of playful works, which are most of the ones that most Christians read, he was playing with, you know, classical works. And so he's playing with these tensions. And in fact, throughout the history of the church, Christians have been playing with these tensions. Part of what happened, again, in modernity is that everything just sort of went up here. And what I mean by that is all of the modernists just started imagining that everything they talk about is sort of in categoricals and universals and eternals. Like, laws of nature are categorical, universal, and eternal. Okay, well, what about before the singularity? Multiple universes. Oh, okay. Yeah. How much evidence for that? Theoretical. Oh, okay. And but, you know, Christians basically did the same thing. And I talked about that with vocal distance. You've got these, I heard many Christians say things like, well, what you have to do, the way you interpret the Bible is that you find these principles, and these principles that are sort of behind sort of the poetry and the narrative, you sort of shake out the principles like you would shake, this is a very Northern California, like you would shake almonds from an almond tree. Now, that's what they say in Ripon. Or almonds from an almond tree, because they shake the, and then you say, why do you call almonds almonds? Well, they're almonds when they're in the tree, and we shake the L out of them. It's a little joke about how they get almonds out of a tree. But it's, you're dealing with, let's say, categoricals versus, say, first person things. And there are the tensions that are happening as we work through this. So now when he talks about the gospel, I can't say what's going on in his mind, but probably what's going on in the ears of most of the listeners is, after you die, anticipated.
No matter who you are, no matter what you've done, God loves you. And he died on a cross so that your...
Now, this gets into a lot of other interesting theological things that we won't get into. But let's see what Jesus says about sinners. We'll go through that. What's wrong with the critic's view?
Here's what's wrong with this attitude. First, it can lead to unfounded, calumnious accusations. I've seen people say of porn producer converts from OnlyFans that these women quit once they get too old to make money on the platform, and conversion is the next best way for them to make money. But this is usually offered up without any proof, even when common sense says that for many of these women, they
could... And obviously, the other thing that's just dripping in this is judgment. It's like, how do you know what's in her mind? Now, maybe as she gets a little older, she's wisening up and realizing, I've made some really bad career choices, and I really need to do something else. So, I mean, this is... I do want to catch a little bit of the Pearl Davis stuff.
They could still have made lots of money if they kept producing porn. Pearl Davis got into the act last week through several posts saying that Nala was actually using Michael Knowles to boost her platform, and she didn't cancel her OnlyFans account. Except her account does not exist anymore.
But now again, if you keep track of these things with respect to the tension between realized and anticipated, people, again, the Ross Douthat quote about, if people didn't like the religious right, they're really not going to like the irreligious right. That's probably going to be the quotation of our age. Because if you're fundamentally secular, you can have no mercy. You can extend no mercy. And that's part of what all of these really weird traps that are developing, that you watch sort of happening, because you can have no mercy, because again, if you want to bring heaven down, you are going to pull hell up. And now he's basically going to say, you know, there's just a lot of skepticism about a whole bunch of these guys who are, we'll just let him play.
Of immediate distrust, scorn, and resentment towards just one type of sinner who converts. I've seen this same attitude before when liberal Catholics complain about the mere possibility of the conversions of celebrities like Russell Brand or Tucker Carlson, who are critical of liberalism. They act like those kinds of people are going to ruin their church. So if it's wrong for liberals to complain about God's grace being given to people that they loathe, then it's wrong when conservatives do the same thing. We should not treat one kind of sinner as being unredeemable just because we find their sin especially loathsome.
And again, a big piece of this is the standard template was the conservatives are judgmental and unwelcome and uncaring. And now what we've seen in the last number of years is that unloving, unwelcome, and uncaring is a basic part of the package of human depravity. No matter where you are on this supposed spectrum of right and left, you're more than capable of it. And in fact, the really important achievement is a capacity to forgive, especially if that forgiveness costs you. It's C.S. Lewis's quip, you know, everybody thinks forgiveness is a good idea until they have something to forgive. So I really like this video, but I really wanted to point out this dynamic between realized and anticipated, not just in terms of, let's say, eschatology, but in terms of how we use many of these other terms.
Imagine if we treated Protestant pastors who convert to Catholicism like this.
Did he just say Protestant pastors are like OnlyFans girls? Now, I'm not saying OnlyFans girls are worse sinners than Protestant pastors. Because the truth is, those who aspire to teach will be held to a higher standard. And so I actually think that, you know, I actually think there's probably a lot of Protestant pastors that are in worse shape than an OnlyFans girl. And potentially can do far more harm than an OnlyFans girl. But hey, you know, I got to this part of the video, and a million trollish. I was tempted to pull out the video editor and just have some fun with this, because I thought, yeah. But then again, I thought, yeah. Anyway, I had to include this part of the video. But I do want to, let's see. I thought there was something over here too that I wanted to cover. Oh, I guess he went over some other thing about Miss B, and I didn't know about any of this stuff either. So, again, the point of this video is not that. Okay, how can I sum this up? The kinds of fights we are going to have are going to be interesting. People on the right are going to say things that sound like people on the left. And people on the left are going to say things that sound like people on the right. You can help understand some of the tensions, and I think live in a richer theological landscape if you sort of, whenever you hear people use little code words like salvation or saved, and anybody who's listened to my sermons, you can hear me make this point back 20 years. You should slow that buzzword down. And you should maybe see it in the filter of realized and anticipated. And again, secularists will cut off the anticipated, because I'm skeptical about that. Oh, I think you're going to wind up with a lot of trouble. Miroslav Volf was pointing that out a generation ago. But pay attention to these fights when they happen, and listen carefully and watch the claims that people make. Now, do people who behave poorly do damage? Yes. Is this a matter of individuals doing things and structures doing things? Yes. But, you know, watch the whole structural conversations too, because those will tend to cut both ways as well. So this was pretty rambly. Let me know if this was helpful to you, or if I have made just another one of my unwatchable, rambly, confusing videos on my channel, for which I have to take full credit, and perhaps someday will charge me as someone worse than an OnlyFans girl, Protestant minister, who's polluted the world with all of his yakking. So let me know.